Mr. Mayor, ladies and gentlemen, I really feel greatly honoured this evening to have been asked to introduce our speaker. But really, I don't have to introduce our speaker. We all know him so well. He's just one of us. It's always so obvious if you go past the Oak Room window anytime, any afternoon, between 2:30 and 4, you will see so many of us sitting at his feet, listening to his words of wisdom. Perhaps I shouldn't say sitting at his feet because he's sitting on the floor. He really does bring magic into our lives, if only we could all think, feel, and live the way he tells us, our lives would be magical. This evening, his talk is called Gotterdammer
Roach.
Gotterdammer. The Twilight of the Gods. And I know we are all going to be spellbound listening to him. Mr. Mayor.
Madam Chairman, Venerable Sirs, Ladies and Gentlemen, let us concern ourselves this hour with the twilight of the gods. Born in the dawn of psychological time, they rule the thralls of ignorance and craving till the long night of the cosmos lays them to rest in the oblivion of sleep. We cannot ignore them or dismiss them out of vain conceit or pride. But whoso is enlightened can go beyond them all. The gods are many. There are the evil gods, Mara the death dealer and deceiver, and his hosts, craving, discontent and passion, ambition and envy, fear and hate, and power lust, who spells wars and cruel oppressions. Send them to their doom, and the forces of evil are impotent against you. There are the mischievous gods of the everyday world. Success, security, money, pleasure, worldly culture, and self-aggrandizement. Put them aside, and you walk out of the prison of self-orientation and separateness. There are the celestials, the Brahmas, the four great kings, as they are called, the 33 Devas, the Yama Devas, and many others, including the devas of the planes of form and formlessness associated with the jhanas and the samapattis. The Buddha tells the Brahmin youth Sangharva of the Bharadvaja clan, "Certainly it is known to me that there are devas." There are also other gods, harsh jailers exercising oppressive sway over us. Doctrine, dogma, belief, conviction, prejudice, bias, preconception, assumption, idea, ideal, knowledge, philosophy, thought, experience, memory, and others of all that brood. The I am conceit is their father, unenlightenment their mother. Light up the darkness, slough away the conceit, and unshakable freedom of mind is yours. Purely for convenience, let us use this word gods in a very loose sense to include strictly defined terms such as Isvara, a creator deity, Devas, a term applied to certain human and non-human beings, and according to Buddhist teachings, mortal and subject to karma, to include sorrow-begetting gods, such as golden calves and self-indulgence, to include the high gods of several pantheons, the deities and angelic hierarchies of various religions, and also to include the archetypal forms and forces in various teachings. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam state that the archangelic and angelic orders were created by God. In Zarathustrianism, the Ameshaspans are the creation of Aura Mazda. The Rig Veda calls the high gods the children of Aditi, the unbound or infinite. The Shatapatha Brahmana states that Brahman creates Agni, Vayu and Surya and makes them lords of earth, air and sky, and itself goes beyond. Then Brahman returns again by means of name and form. And as far as name and form extend, so far does the universe extend. The Hindus have hosts of devas, celestial as well as demonic, and the Buddha takes them as a matter of course. Even as Hinduism presents the gods with their consorts, Buddhism presents Dhyani Buddhas with their consorts. You, the human being, are the progenitor of the gods. Be they high gods, celestials, mischievous gods, or demons. When you yourself, in deep meditation, are beyond duality, in that unified state where there is no obtrusive I am conceit, there is only transcendent awareness. When all evil-mindedness has been burnt out, you are the Holy One. When you are in that silent communion, where there is the cessation of perception and feeling, the one total reality is manifest as realized transcendence through you. This is the state of the one only, not born, not becoming, not dying. Free of any separate self-consciousness, you are awake to the fact that transcendence, pure mind, and the natural world are in timeless conjugation. In course of time, there is the return journey to ordinary discriminative consciousness, and once again, you are in the realm of the many. It is during this return journey that the creation by you of your psycho-spiritual cosmos takes place, and the one proliferates and becomes the many, taking the shapes made by the interpretive activity of your discriminative consciousness in accordance with its conditioning by your cultural heritage. Thereafter, you, the Holy One, may try to communicate the experiencing of transcendence to earnest learners in terms of God and or the high gods. This communication, which purports to be the knowledge of the nature and functioning of the transcendent cosmic energy which is presented as God or as the high gods, is the meaning of the word theosophy. The strictest and finest theosophy is the unwritten revelation. The Kabbalah, of which there are formal expressions such as the books of Moses, the writings of the Kabbalists, the Zohar, etc., the original Veda, of which the formal expressions are the written Vedas, the Upanishads, etc., the primordial Buddha Dhamma, which was relit in our world age by the Enlightened One through his utterance of the Brahmavada. You, the Holy One, may also try to convey transcendence as Brahman Atma, as the not born, not becoming, not dying, as Shunyata, as Nibbana, as Godhead, as the divine dark, as the absolute. Recall the statement made earlier: transcendence, pure mind, and the natural order are in timeless conjugation. They mutually fecundate each other. The impress of transcendence upon pure mind is interpreted by the Holy One as the archetypal forces. Plato, for example, presented them as the ideas, truth, goodness, beauty. Others have presented them as the laws governing the spiritual life. Others as spiritual hierarchies in charge of cosmic and human evolution. Although pure mind is formless, the psyche, conditioned by one's particular cultural heritage and environment, imaginatively clothes the impress of transcendence upon pure mind in various forms, a wonderful psychological key for understanding oneself and one's race. We must now consider a crucial point. Transcendence is nitya, that is, it is absolute, immeasurable, indestructible, unconditioned. Nor space, nor time, nor causality, nor process apply to it. The only words we can use in connection with it are those which deny or negate our whole system of knowledge, which is dependent upon the workings of our senses and discriminative consciousness, vijnana. Transcendence is the unknown and unknowable. I cannot touch or know or experience transcendence. But if I empty myself, if there is no selfness, then this very self is wholly transparent to the light of transcendence. Pure mind also is immeasurable. Akasha is mind space. space devoid of separation and distances, devoid of time and of the usual dimensions of physical space, of which we are conscious through our vijnana. It is self-shining. Its shining is the light of transcendence. Pure mind and transcendence are formless. On rare occasions, the activity of our vijnana seems to reach out into the formless and immeasurable. And then, it inevitably interprets transcendence and pure mind in the terms of its own limitations and categories, such as space, time, finite particulars, and so on. In other words, in terms of form and the movement of successive events, that is, in terms of birth and death, of the relative, anicca. This is our crucial point. This is where our difficulty lies. We are driven to represent the infinite in the figure of the finite. Furthermore, being in the state of ignorance, we tend to believe and to act on the belief that our formal representations are the truth, the reality. And we fail to be awake to the fact that they are all illusory where transcendence and pure mind are concerned. The religious life is concerned with the realization of transcendence. This necessitates a basis of pure conduct of body, speech, and thought in daily life. It involves the purification and emptying of the mind and a complete transformation of the mode of awareness of that which is here now. This means a total release from the samsaric mode into the nirvanic. To this end, we have to see and to live by the fact that our existential self or being, the nama rupa, is relative, anicca, not transcendent, anatta, far from the infinite, dukkha. If this is done, it means that we are unselfed, or that we are egoless beings. Then indeed, we are true humans. Let us now consider some difficulties. We believe that we can look objectively or dispassionately at a person or thing. In actual fact, our looking is tainted with greed and hate and delusion. So too is our hearing, touching, etc. So too our planning, investigating, feeling, aspiring, worshipping, and striving. We believe we can distinguish what is good and true. But if we are really mindful, we continuously discover that our capacity for distinguishing correctly is woefully short. What we actually do is to grasp at an idea, a feeling, a pattern of thought. In short, the entire functioning of our vijnana, our discriminative consciousness, is tainted throughout with greed, hate, and delusion. Thus, even when we try to tread the path, or imagine we are so doing, we are still in miserable servitude to the gods. If we are mindful, we will see that we are still self-oriented, still pleasure-bent, still grasping at nirvana or Buddhahood and deluded as to the significance and meaning of those words. We give them meanings and form conceptions about them out of our dead past. So strong is the drive of craving that we struggle with might and main to win by force our pictured transcendence, a mere sankhara. And we continue in this state of conflict and woe, blind to the fact that we are caught in the web of words, a web of our own making. The release from the trap of words and servitude to the gods is effected in the jhanas and samapatis, in which a progressive dissolution of all thought patterns and verbal structures, such as beliefs, assumptions, doctrines, laws, and so on, takes place. A jhana is a state of attentiveness. Ordinarily, we are in a state of confusion. Our attention is like a straw in the wind. In the first jhana, there is an orderly movement of discursive thought. Dhammadinna, the nun, tells Visakha, discursive thought is activity of speech. This speech is a flow of the known or the past, a flow of thought forms shaped and structured by the tainted vijnana. Among these thought forms or verbal structures are the usual set topics for meditation. And the process of the meditation is a modified continuity of what is already known. Very rarely the really new is present, your flash of inspiration, the forward step. The thought forms are fixations. We hold on to them and they become our hindrances. In the second jhana, the flow of discursive thought, which is speech, becomes quiescent. So also does the flow of internal sense impressions, visual, auditory, tactile, etc., all of which at root are associated with words. And thus you experience the first death. It is essential to understand this. Consider carefully the significance of the word. With very rare exceptions, all words represent a thing or action or quality, etc., each of which is limited, finite, and particular, which comes into being, changes, and perishes, which is cognized through the use of our senses and brain by the tainted and unenlightened vijnana. Discriminative consciousness, which, by the very fact of discrimination, takes sides, perpetuates conflict, and is always fragmentary. And therefore, you are never wholly one with the truth, the one total reality. Thus, words represent the realm of duality and mortality. Therefore, when the flow of speech and sense impressions is quiescent, whilst you are awake and fully attentive, not asleep or dead, a new dimension of being and consciousness stirs out of the depths of the mind, and you are aware of a far profounder life which is speechless. This is the first, and in some respects, the most important transformation of the mode of awareness. Hitherto, you were fragmentarily aware in the mode of mortality. Now, you are beginning to realize the unified mind, so that the vijnana, becoming more free of its defilements, begins to apprehend things and persons and situations in their wholeness. Now, the cosmology of Buddhism is a cosmology of the mind world, not of the physical world, like our modern scientific cosmologies. It is a psychocosmic system. The Buddhist universe of mind deals with fact, the reality of which depends on its psychological truth and the possibility of its experience in one or other state of consciousness. This may or may not include materiality in association with mentality. We must be prepared then, conditioned as we are by our modern education, to meet with a strangeness in the verbal formulation of this psychocosmic system. We must bear in mind that all the heavens and hells with their populations are within our minds as possibilities of consciousness. We classify and name these immaterial denizens of the mind world in accordance with our socio-cultural heritage. In India, we call them devas. In the Judeo-Christian and Islamic traditions, they are called archangels and angels, etc. But with this difference, that in contrast to the Indian view, they are regarded as created by God and as immortal, and not as beings who are subject to death or who are creations of our own minds. The psychocosmic system of Buddhism represents three realms: that of sensuous desire, Kamaloka, of pure form, Rupaloka, and of the formless, Arupaloka. In the jhanas, attention is centered in the realm of pure form. Although the jhanas are referred to as first, second, third, and fourth, do not regard them as if they were rungs on a ladder. It is more as if you were in an envelope of water or of air. The profounder the jhana, the less the fluctuations of the mind in this realm of pure form, a realm of mind forms, and the envelope of water or air, in our simile, is less disturbed by currents. The number attached to a jhana indicates its intensity and nature. Five important factors characterize the initial jhana state, specifically directed attention to the subject in hand, brought back again and again if the mind wanders. This removes sloth and torpor. Sustained attention, which removes doubt. Distinguish this doubt, mere cavilling or cantankerous opposition out of folly or vanity, from that healthy doubt which impels us to serious investigation. Rapture, which removes hate. Happiness, which removes restlessness and mental worry. And single-mindedness, usually called one-pointedness, which removes greed. As you move closer to the single-minded state, each of the first four factors fades away, and the demon associated with each, sloth, doubt, etc., is consigned to limbo. By the going down of former pleasure and sorrow, you enter upon and abide in the fourth jhana, which is entirely purified by mindfulness and equanimity. In this state, there is freedom from separate self-consciousness. There is no I association with any of the constituents of being, bodily or mental. Thus, the true meaning of the word I, freed from the I am conceit, is realized. The Buddha constantly uses the word aham, I. We generally use it to signify something relative or ephemeral, as when we remark, I am hungry or tall or elated. Here the fact is that there is hunger or tallness or elation apparent for the time being. According to the ancient wisdom, aham means the reality which cannot be denied after the sense of separate selfhood of an I entity is dissolved. Aham is the unabandonable. If we do see this, there is realization that the I is in fact the one total reality, manifesting itself as innumerable, finite, self-cognizing forms. Thus, when one is well awake to this fact, one who is well awake to this fact, uses the word I, that I refers to the one and only universal I, of which the existential being or the nama-rupa known in the world by one's name is a focus of manifestation. The attentiveness of the fourth jhana is entirely purified by mindfulness and equanimity, is a state of silence. A silence which absorbs all sound without being perturbed. Its upekkha, equanimity, is such that it is the culmination of love, that is, of metta, karuna, and mudita, and it is a peace which allows awareness to be whole, not merely analytical or separative. It is free of conflict, for it does not take sides or indulge in preferential choice. In the fourth jhana, you are in the unresisting state. The mind is pliable, clean, and empty of all the thought forms which are raised up by the activity of desire. In this state, craving cannot reach you, for with the quiescence of separate self-consciousness, self-centered desire cannot act. With craving gone, there cannot be an uprising of another jati, a conditioned state. Being in the unconditioned state, being free of the flow of discursive speech and thought and sense images, unobstructed prajna, that is, unerring insight, operates in your awareness. Thus, with prajna and karuna functioning freely through you in upekkha, you realize another death. Death, the liberation out of the finitude of the five aggregates, out of the limitations of vijnana, into the infinitude of pure mind. This is the entry into the samapattis, or coalescences. The organism which is you, in silent stillness, is now in the mindless state. This means that what is commonly called my mind or your mind which in fact is merely the ephemeral flow of mental patterns, having become empty, and because there is perfect ease and poise, is utterly transparent and shining. It is the all mind, Akasha, the mind space, shining with the light of transcendence. This mind space has no dimensions geometrically, no length, no breadth, no depth. It is not measurable in terms of finitude. But it is immeasurably full in terms of archetypal forces, fecundated as it is by transcendence, and its dimensions are in terms of the fullness, that is, the intensity of pure consciousness. The infinity of Akasha necessarily implies the infinity of Vijnana. When there is the seeing of the fullness of emptiness, then only there is the seeing of emptiness. And pure consciousness is the fullness of the emptiness. The movement out of the fourth jhana and the entry and abiding in the infinity of Akasha and Vijnana takes place, as the Buddha teaches, by passing quite beyond perception of material shapes, by the going down of perception of sensory reactions, by not attending to perception of variety. This statement is very important, for it means that in the sphere of infinity, all discriminative perception ceases. The requisite bases of Vijnana, space, time, separation, measurability, have all disappeared. This unconditioned, uniformly calm realm is the realm of primordial creative action by that aspect of cosmic energy which is called the power of God, the incomprehensible deity, of Brahman or Atma, the unknown infinite, in the esoteric teachings of various religions. In this connection, you will find some interesting points in the Mahavagga and also in the Samyutta Nikaya, the third volume. This unfolding of the unknown transcendence in infinity, displaying the movement of divine power, is the essential subject matter of theosophy. But how shall Vijnana, especially the tainted Vijnana of mortals imprisoned in the circle of death, namely the Paticca Samuppada from Avijja to Jara Marana, ever talk about the ways of God or the workings of transcendence and try to fit them into the finite framework upreared by Vijnana? Out of his great compassion, the Lord Buddha taught us that investigation was one of the limbs of enlightenment. And he also taught the indispensability of the foundation of pure morality. Beware then of the lure of power lust as a motive force impelling us to investigate. Leave alone all power. It is invariably and inevitably misused until every vestige of taint is out of your mind and heart, and the harmony of transcendent love and wisdom flows in a healing stream out of your unselfed being for the joy and the peace of all mankind. And in the infinity of Akasha and Vijnana, transcendent love and wisdom will flood your being and radiate into the world. Before we proceed further, let us go back to the beginning and pick up another thread. as you outgrow the life of slavery to sense pleasure, you move out of Kamaloka, the state of confinement to sensuous living. In its higher reaches are included the devas, named the four great kings, the 33 gods, and so on. You go beyond them, till in the first jhana you come to the great Brahma and his ministers and retinues. In the second, to the devas of minor, infinite, and radiant luster, paritabha, apamanabha, abhasara. In the third, to the devas of minor, infinite, and steady aura. I won't repeat all the Pali names again. And in the fourth, to the devas of the realm of great reward, of mindless being, and of the pure abodes. This last includes the durable, serene, beautiful, clear-sighted, and the highest realms with their respective devas. You may wonder, who or what are these devas, corporeal or non-corporeal? If you're interested, it may be helpful in this connection to study discourses 1, 37, 49, and 50 in the Majjhima Nikaya. But the wise man will concern himself less with a verbal answer to the question and more with understanding the nature of curiosity. If you meet with devas, be grateful for any wisdom you may cull, but do not grasp at anything. Remain circumspect. As you move through the jhanas to your ingathering into reality, you will become free of bondage to the gods. The process culminates in the third samapatti, the plane of no thing. Note that all this is not just another mode of ordinary thinking, mere words. It is a transformation of awareness, the awareness which implies being that which you are aware of. In other words, the separation between seeing subject and observed object is vanishing, and there is a coalescence of the two. Verbal statements become increasingly inept as you go on. They are made only because we are trying to communicate with each other. In nothing awareness, the deeply hidden mental impressions, the inherited archetypal images, and the ingrained natural urges derived from the animal origin of the body and of that part of the psyche associated with it, all dissolve away. For here, the culmination of mindfulness, satipatthana, takes place. In the daily practice, all the components of the existential being were seen with right wisdom to be relative, not transcendent, sorrowful, and you said of each of them, "This is not mine, this am I not, this is not the atta of me." So you did not grasp at them. Now, in nothing, there is no intrusion upon awareness by any of them. Now, there is the dissolution, the complete dissolution of all your ideals, of all your rigid, misleading thought forms in which vijnana structured, ungraspable, formless truth, of your paths to enlightenment and your pictured enlightenment itself, of your high gods who represented all that mortals call best and perfect, of your firmest convictions that the true and good and beautiful is eternal and indestructible, all of it will vanish in that no-thing, which is the very substance of the infinite. In the Prajnaparamita, the Buddha said to Sariputta, Bodhisattva, perfect wisdom, form, etc., are mere words, magical illusions. They are not, do not arise, are false to behold. And to Subhuti, enlightenment is attained neither through a path nor through a no path. Just the path is enlightenment. Just enlightenment is the path. Most awesome of all is the realization that the power of transcendence acts as a rhythmic pulse of destruction-regeneration. It shatters whatsoever is formed and established and reduces it to its primordial nothingness. And it fecundates this thingless mind space with life energy from which springs forth the new cosmos. And the night of dissolution is followed by the dawn of new creation. Neither fear the night, nor cling to the day, nor hold your head high in pride before the transcendent power, but let your whole being burn with outstreaming love and wisdom in selfless living. Stay still now, for there is yet a slight oscillation, an inclining towards an unperceivable that, and a withdrawing into a perceiving self. It is a faint tremble of fear. Give way to it, and you will be flung back into limited self-consciousness by a dark, tumultuous confusion. Stay still, for beyond the topmost summit of becoming is the cessation. The cessation of the relative, the state of bondage. Then there is only the light of transcendence. Liberated from the grasp of flesh, psyche is now one with Eros. The Eros which is transcendence creating in timeless conjugation with pure mind and nature, and not that Eros which confused impure mortals know. And with the twilight of the gods, the world is redeemed by love and liberated by wisdom. And heaven's benediction restores to earth its pristine fragrance.
Wow. Well, you certainly have spun your old magic again tonight. I think Mr. Mehta has given us a tremendous lot to think about, to ponder on. And I'm sure you will all join me in thanking him tremendously for this wonderful talk. Do we have some questions
tomorrow? Tomorrow morning at 10:15, Mr. Mehta.
That's painful.
So tomorrow morning at 10:15, you may have your questions to ask Mr. Mehta. Thank you very much.